It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. There's a new sheriff in town, a new U.S. law requiring cybercrime reporting. We'll take a look at that. A surprise supply chain sabotage from one of the developers and maintainers of Node.js. And a new way to spoof sign-in dialogues. It's called Browser in Browser, and it's scary. Plus, Steve will take a deep dive into a common source of security flaws called the use after free bug. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 863, recorded Tuesday, March 22nd, 2022. Use after free. This episode of Security Now is brought to you by Barracuda. Barracuda has identified 13 types of email threats and how cyber criminals use them every day. Phishing, conversation hacking, ransomware, plus 10 more tricks cyber criminals use to steal money from your company or personal information from your employees and customers. Get your free ebook at barracuda.com/securitynow. And by Melissa. The U.S. Postal Service processes more than 98,000 address changes every day. Make sure your customer contact data is up to date. Try Melissa's APIs in the developer portal. It's easy to log on, sign up, and start playing in the API sandbox 24/7. Get started today with 1,000 records clean for free at melissa.com/twit. And by PlexTrack, the proactive security management platform that helps you focus on winning the right security battles. With PlexTrack, you'll streamline the full workflow from reporting to remediation. Visit PlexTrack.com/twit and claim your free month. It's time for Security Now, the show we cover your security, your privacy, everything you need to know about staying safe online with this cat right here, Steve Gibson, GRC. He's doing the... Now I know why you love Babaverse, by the way. It's Star Trek focus. There's a lot of Star Trek jokes in there.
There is, actually. In fact, you won't know it. I don't remember if it's in the third book or the fourth, but there's actually that as they there's this thing replicative drift, where
yes, where even though he's replicating himself, each one is slightly different,
which you know, it's like, why is a computer going to have that? But yeah, it's a required, you know,
it's an AI and you need it, otherwise they'd all be the same.
Exactly. So it's a required plot vehicle for him in order to get different Bobs as all these Bobs keep replicating. So what happens is over time, there are some, though, and of course, you're right, Star Trek is a theme through the
series. Well, one of the Bobs
series
names himself Riker.
Oh, yes.
Bob
Will,
number two.
Fact.
Yeah.
Yes. And in fact, and he later drops Riker and just switches to Will. But still, it's that connection.
Yep.
But then what happens is they, as things go on, they start involving themselves with other cultures. I mean, not in a bad way, like to help out these other intelligent, sentient aliens who they find.
They violate the prime directive?
Yes. There is a group that forms that are all up in arms about this, and they literally get labeled Starfleet.
I'm just finishing the first book because you shamed me last week saying, have I read it yet? And I hadn't started it. And I love it. It reminds me so much of the Martian and Project Hail Mary in the attitude of the narrator. Of course, I'm listening to Ray Porter's narration. It's the same guy. So he's got that same kind of funny attitude, and in the science writing and the problem solving, it is another Andy Weir. Andy Weir too is really good. It's called the Babaverse. First one's called We Are Legion by, I can't remember the guy's name, something E. I know his middle name is E.
Well, and in fact, I was just thinking about this yesterday. There's no spoilers here, but there's a moment where there's a problem that's being solved, and they're needing to to rotate their passwords and update their keys. And I'm like, I mean, that's what the guy is talking about.
I know,
like,
I love
no
it.
No wonder our listeners love this stuff. Yeah.
Dennis E. Taylor. And
Dennis Taylor.
They're great, I have to say. And I've only read the first one, but so far I'm really, really enjoying
it. You won't be let down.
Yeah, yeah.
So today we are at 322.22, and there wasn't any big, I mean, there's like a lot going on, of course, because we still have all of this tension globally. But a number of our listeners have written with questions about use after free. We've talked about this vulnerability, how it continues to keep being a problem. And when I saw that, you know, after like looking at everything that I wanted to talk about this week, there wasn't anything that was clearly topical, I thought, well, I'm just going to, you know, spend some time digging a little bit deeper into this issue of memory management in our contemporary computer systems to answer sort of as a group a lot of these questions that we've had. So I titled today's podcast Use After Free, just because it's the way we're going to wrap things up. But first, we're going to take a look at the U.S.'s new cybercrime reporting law, which finally did get passed and signed into law last week. We're going to examine the most tweeted to me thing of the week, which was a very worrisome software supply chain sabotage. But and even more worrisome than one instance is that it turns out this is looking like a trend, and it is concerning. We're going to look at the browser in the browser exploit, a new way to spoof sign-in dialogues to capture authentication credentials, and examine the way MikroTik, or as I originally called them, MikroTik routers, are being used by the TrickBot botnet to obscure their command and control servers. We've got a infinite loop bug of great concern, which has been uncovered by our friend Tavis Ormandy at Google in OpenSSL, which is what makes it a big concern. Time to update. And CISA walks us through their forensic analysis of a Russian state-sponsored attack on an NGO, a non-governmental organization. We then take a look at the Windows vulnerability that refuses to be resolved. And we'll finish, as I said, by spending a bit more time than we have so far to looking more closely at why use after free flaws continue to be so challenging. And we also, for those who are coders, we have a terrific picture of the week. So
that's kind of relevant, too. Hey, there's also a news story that I want to point you to and let you chew over it before we talk again. Of course, you spent many years working on Squirrel, a better way of doing passwords. I don't know if you saw this, but the FIDO Alliance has said, oh, we think we now know how to enter a password passwordless world. They say, I'll just quote a little bit of it. The passwordless FIDO standard already relies on device biometric scanners to authenticate you locally without any of your data traveling over the internet to a web server for validation. The main concept FIDO believes will ultimately solve the new device issue, because, of course, switching and adding devices is becomes the problem. Is to implement a FIDO credential manager. This sounds a little bit familiar, which is somewhat similar to a built-in password manager. Instead of literally storing passwords, this mechanism will store cryptographic keys that can sync between devices and are guarded by your device's biometric or passcode lock. I think yours is a little better, to be honest. My
only needs one, and it synthesizes them on the fly based on where you are, as we know. So,
the problem is FIDO is, you know, Apple and Microsoft and Google, and you're just you.
And and you have not seen me spend any more time after I spent 7 years solving the problem. I dropped it like a hot rock and switched to SpinRite because I solved the problem. If the world wants it, great. Otherwise, fine.
Somebody should write to FIDO and say it's been solved. Take a look. because you address the exact thing they're talking about, the portability of these keys, and you address it in, I think, a better way than they're talking
about.
Yeah,
and, you know, all kinds of little edge cases, like users telling the website, oh, you know, I lost my key, please, you know, let me use something else.
Right.
Well, that's an obvious exploit for spoofing, and so with Squirrel, you can set a little checkbox that says, please don't ever listen to those requests. And so, I mean, this, and, you know, and if you lose your credentials, how you can get them back, how you're able to obsolete lost credentials. I mean, you know, I did solve it once.
Yep.
And there it is.
Yep.
So, meanwhile, I'm having a lot of fun making great progress with SpinRite.
Good. We'll hear more about that in just a second. And get our picture of the week as well, Steve Gibson and Security Now. But first, a word from our sponsor. They make the show possible, Barracuda. They also do a lot more than that. They protect companies, including ours, from all sorts of threats, including, I think, in many ways, the number one threat for phishing anyway, email. In a recent email trends survey, 43% of respondents told Barracuda they'd been victims. 43% had been victims of a spear phishing attack. That's terrifying. In fact, only 23% said they have dedicated spear phishing protection. So I think it's time to start looking at how you keep your email secure for your company, for your clients. Barracuda has identified 13 types of email threats and how cyber criminals use them every day. They're right there on the front line, so they know phishing, conversation hacking, of course, ransomware, and 10 more tricks cyber criminals use to steal money from your company, to steal personal information from your employees and customers, to steal your source code if you're Microsoft. The question is, are you protected against all 13 types? Email cybercrime is becoming more sophisticated. Attacks are more difficult to prevent. They're using social engineering. And of course, they prey on victims with fear and urgency to get them to act, you know, without thinking. Social engineering attacks, including spear phishing and business email compromise, cost businesses an average of $130,000 per incident. A lot of people, it's costing them millions. And of course, it's always tied to, you know, things that scare people and current events. When the demand for COVID tests increased at the start of the year, Barracuda researchers saw, of course, an increase in COVID-19 test-related phishing attacks. 521% increase between October of 2021 and January of 2022. 521% increase. As more and more people are interested in crypto, the opportunity for attacks becomes ripe. Of course, with the price of Bitcoin being what it is, It's gone down, Steve. Don't worry. It's gone down. Barracuda research found that impersonation attacks grew 192% when Bitcoin went up. Hey, there's something valuable there. We want it. In 2020, the Internet Crime Compliance Center, IC3, received 19,369 business email compromise, email account compromise complaints with adjusted losses of over $1.8 billion. It's not enough just to secure your email at the gateway. You've got to, of course, leverage gateway security. That's why we use Barracuda to protect against traditional attacks, viruses, zero-day ransomware, spam, and other threats. But a target attack goes right through. Protection at the inbox level, including AI and machine learning, is necessary to detect and stop the most sophisticated threats. And Barracuda's right there with you, too. Get a free copy of Barracuda's report. 13 email threat types to know about right now. You'll see what the cyber criminals are up to, how they're getting more and more sophisticated every day, and how you can build the best protection for your business, your data, your people with Barracuda. Find out how the 13 email threat types work and what you can do about them, and how Barracuda can provide complete email protection for your teams, your customers, and your reputation. It's free, and it's available right now at barracuda.com/securitynow. Your free ebook, 13 email threat types to know about right now, Barracuda, barracuda.com/securitynow. And you know what? You should probably pass it around the organization, too, I think. Let everybody know. Barracuda, your journey secured. All right, Steve, picture of the week time.
So this is just a fun one. It depicts the six stages of debugging, which, as I said, most of us who have written code will understand. The first stage is the "that can't happen" stage. You know, I we would call that denial. I guess.
Yeah.
Then we have exactly. Then the second one is, well, that doesn't happen on my machine. It's like, wait a minute, you know, something wrong with your computer. It's all good here.
I can't duplicate that. Yeah,
that's right. Exactly, can't duplicate it. Then the next stage of as the coder moves through this painful process is, that shouldn't happen. And so stage three, then when the coder has recognized, okay, well, I guess it is happening, we get to the fourth stage. Why does that happen? And then when that gets, realized and internalized, we get to the fifth stage of, oh, I see.
In big letters. Oh, I see.
Exactly. And then I love stage six, which is like, I've felt it before. It's like, how did that ever work?
So true.
It's like, my God, you know, how did it take until now to find that? But yeah, that's the nature of the process. Okay, so last Tuesday, a $1.5 trillion government funding bill was signed into law. That I think that gets us like keeps us ticking until September. President Biden signed it, and we're talking about that because part of that, part of what was packaged into that legislation is something we've touched on a few times when it had periodically been discussed. But what was under consideration until now, and it was only under consideration, became law. That new law mandates that owners and operators of critical U.S. infrastructure, to be defined in a minute, must report when their organization has been hacked and if a ransomware payment has been made. So this so-called, it's called the Strengthening American Cybersecurity Act of 2022, and unfortunately, no good acronym jumps out. SACA, SACA. I don't know. It's not very catchy. Anyway, it was attached to the spending bill, which requires, as I said, critical infrastructure operators alert the Homeland Security Department's CISA, you know, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, within 72 hours, 3 days, of a breach, and within 1 day, 24 hours, if the organization makes a ransomware payment. This new legislation also grants CISA subpoena power, allowing it to compel testimony from any entities which they believe have not reported a cyber incident or a ransomware payment. And what's interesting is that this move is a reversal in recent policy because this legislation was removed, or as the legislators like to say, stripped out of the recent annual defense policy bill where it first tried to make it into law, and that was signed a few months ago. So, given this change of heart, one has to wonder whether the potential for attacks against U.S. infrastructure, which would be secondary to the Ukraine-Russian conflict, might be behind this change of heart. And my eyebrows rose when I was learning that this so-called Strengthening American Cybersecurity Act passed the Senate unanimously. So, no dissent at all. Yes.
Wow.
Let's do. I know. Like, when is the last thing something was unanimous in our U.S. Senate recently? So, you know, again, it's no skin off anyone's teeth. They're basically saying, notify us if something happens. So now CISA will have up to 2 years to publish a notice in the Federal Register on proposed rulemaking to implement the reporting effort. You know, nothing ever happens quickly. However, reporting on this has suggested that CISA might choose to move faster thanks to the current heightened threat climate. The Senate's Homeland Security Committee Chair Gary Peters, who authored and championed the legislation along with Senator Rob Portman, issued a combined statement saying that, quote, this historic new law will make major updates to our cybersecurity policy to ensure that for the first time ever, every single critical infrastructure owner and operator in America is reporting cyber attacks and ransomware payments to the federal government. And additionally, Rob Portman, the panel's top Republican, said the legislation will, quote, give the National Cyber Director, CISA, and other appropriate agencies broad visibility into the cyber attacks taking place across our nation on a daily basis to enable a whole-of-government response, mitigation, and warning to critical infrastructure and others of ongoing imminent attacks. So, As I was researching this, I got to wondering, because it sort of seemed like a loophole to me, maybe, what exactly constitutes critical U.S. infrastructure? You know, we hear the term all the time, but, you know, who exactly would be required to report? So, to answer the question, I attempted to read, and that was the mistake, some of the actual legislation. I don't recommend it, because now I have even less idea how our government actually manages to work, and more amazement that for the most part, it kind of seems to. I did manage to track down Presidential Policy Directive 21, Section 2242. That's right, Section 2242, Subsection B, and under the heading there, Designated Critical Infrastructure Sectors and Sector-Specific Agencies, it explains, this directive identifies 16 critical infrastructure sectors and designates associated federal SSAs. Those are sector-specific agencies, of which DHS is almost always their reporting to agency, the responsible agency. You know, like DOE has the Department of Energy, the DOD has the Department of Defense, obviously, and so forth. But in general, DHS, the umbrella. They said in some cases, co-SSAs are designated where those departments share the roles and responsibilities of the SSA. The Secretary of Homeland Security shall periodically evaluate the need for and approve changes to critical infrastructure sectors and shall consult with the Assistant to the President for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism before changing a critical infrastructure sector or a designated SSA for that actor. The sectors and SSAs are as follows. And as I said, this was after like a lot of distillation and whittling it down because, oh my Lord. Anyway, those 16 are chemical, commercial facilities, communications, critical manufacturing, dams, defense industrial base, emergency services, energy, financial services, food and agriculture, government facilities, healthcare and public health, information technology, nuclear reactors, materials and waste and transportation systems, water and wastewater systems. So anyway, I was curious, in case anybody else is, those are the 16. So the bottom line is reporting attacks and extortion payments is no longer optional. It will be the law. Or it is now, although it looks like CISA has some, has to get, like, since they are the reporting to agency, they've got to, figure out how to turn it into a sufficiently large bureaucracy. Okay. Winning this week's prize for the most listener reported incident was a very worrisome software supply chain event. I don't think it qualifies for being called an attack since it was an inside job. Consequently, most of the tech press is using the term sabotage. NPM is the package manager we've discussed from time to time for today's number one most popular, most used, and most in-demand programming language, JavaScript. NPM is the default package manager for JavaScript's super popular runtime environment, Node.js. And a very prominent Node module known as Node-IPC, as in inter-process communication, which is commonly used for local and remote inter-process communication, which has support for Linux, Mac OS, and Windows, is the subject here. Node-IPC has over 1.1 million downloads per week, which puts it up at the high end of popularity. In the context of Java's, now not JavaScript, Java's Log4j incident and vulnerability, we were talking about code dependency trees. The idea being that one software library relies upon several others, and they may rely upon others, etc., creating this rapidly branching tree, which has the effect of creating a deep set of interdependencies. Lyron Tal at Sync, S-N, or I don't know how you pronounce it, S-N-Y-K?
Snike?
I'll say Sync. Snike? Yeah, maybe. I hope it's not Snike. That'd be bad. Where do you work? I work at Snike.
Snike.
It's like, what? On purpose? Deliberately? Okay, anyway, he was the first to report their discovery of this problem. Lyron wrote, he said, on March 15th, 2022, users of the popular Vue.js front-end JavaScript framework started experiencing what can only be described as a supply chain attack impacting the NPM ecosystem. This was the result of the nested dependencies Node-IPC and Peace Not War being sabotaged as an act of protest by the maintainer of the Node-IPC package. He said, this security incident involves destructive acts of corrupting files on disk by one maintainer and their attempts to hide and restate that deliberate sabotage in different forms. While this is an attack with protest-driven motivations, it highlights a larger issue facing the software supply chain, that the transitive dependencies in your code can have a huge impact on your security. Okay, so the story started back on March 8th, at which time NPM maintainer for this package, RIA Evangelist is his handle. His real world name is Brandon Nozaki Miller. He wrote some code and published an NPM package named Peace Not War, presumably referring to what's going on over in Ukraine. And that package describes itself, quote, this code serves as a non-destructive example of why controlling your Node modules is important. It also serves as a non-violent protest against Russia's aggression that threatens the world right now. This module will add a message of peace on your users' desktops, and it will only do it if it does not already exist, just to be polite. Unquote. Okay, now, first of all, it's interesting that Brandon writes that he'll only place his anti-war message on desktops that have not already received the message, quote, just to be polite, because what Brandon then does is anything but polite. His Peace Not War package sat around for a week with hardly any downloads. Then he adds this Peace Not War module as a dependency to one of his other very popular modules. Apparently he has 40 that he's maintaining. In this case, he added it to the dependency of Node-IPC, which caused it to get sucked down 1.1 million times per week. Then, apparently, still getting even more amped up, over the Russia-Ukraine conflict and feeling that he has the power to be more proactive, Brandon added some deliberately Base 64 obfuscated sabotage code to his Node-IPC package. This updated release added a function to check the IP address of the developers who were using Node-IPC in their own projects. When an IP address geolocated to either Russia or Belarus is found, the new version wiped the file contents from the machine, replacing them with a heart emoji. Okay, now...
Well, at least there's love involved.
There is obviously quite a lot that's wrong about this. Mm. But on top of it just being plain wrong, to take advantage of one's implicitly trusted position as a package maintainer, to have one's package do something that it was clearly not sanctioned to do, Brandon's targets were being very poorly chosen. If we're to believe what we're told about the war sentiments of the Russian population, it's the younger coders and developers who are more likely to be using Russian propaganda bypassing measures and to have a much more Western view of what's actually happening over there. And along comes some idiot in the West who wipes out a sympathetic developer's files only because of where they are coding. And I should mention, it's not in the show notes, but the EFF just went ballistic over this. I mean, whoa. And sad as all that is, even more sadly, Brandon is not alone. The count of similarly recently altered software has risen to 21 incidents separately having been identified. I noted as I looked through the list, it was in Russian, so I wasn't able to read the details, but I could see that the popular GUI toolkit QT was on the list, up near the top, actually. And another is ES5-EXT, which provides code for the ECMAScript 6 scripting language specification. A new dependency named postinstall.js, which the developer added on March 7th, checks to see if the user's computer has a Russian IP address, in which case the code broadcasts a call for peace, whatever that is. So while not all of these changes are destructive, as Brandon's ended up evolving into, they are almost certainly not what those who are using them want or have every right to expect. Now, Brandon quickly removed his malicious changes after the very predictable outcry arose from other enraged developers. But boy, you know, he has certainly not enhanced his credibility or reputation. And, you know, as I said, it does also point out what is probably a larger problem with the fact that we've ended up putting ourselves in a position where we are trusting in the goodwill and the ongoing goodwill and like the unfaltering behavior of lots of random developers whose software we're using, and we link it into a dependency tree and our code grabs it no matter what it is, assuming that it's going to stay what it was before. And, of course, we have no guarantee of that being the case. So, yikes. Next, we're going to talk about this browser and in a browser hack, Leo. But I need to take a sip of water.
Okay. So. Preach. We are going to take a break and talk about Melissa, the address experts. Well, Steve hydrates. You probably know this, but your contact list is pretty vital to your business. Being able to reach customers, suppliers, being able to send out bills, catalogs, that's really important. Problem is, people move.
They move all the time. All the time. Not only move, they change email addresses, they even change names. And phone numbers, too. Melissa solves this problem by helping you ensure your business is successful and your customer information is up to date. In fact, that's why more than 10,000 businesses know them as the address experts. They've been doing this for 37 years with a renewal rate of over 92%. Once you use Melissa, you know you need Melissa. The typical ROI for Melissa customers is 25%. It really saves you money. So you don't mail catalogs, 2 and 3 and 4 catalogs to the same address or bill the wrong people, that kind of thing. Melissa set a record in 2021 last year, 30 billion North American address lookups, 30 billion in 1 year. That's the most ever. And it just shows you how much more people need this than ever before. Melissa does more than just verifying addresses. Addresses, emails, phone numbers, names, and you can do it in real time. They've got an API. You can use the software as a service. You could use it on-prem. There's an FTP, secure FTP server you can upload a file to, get them to clean it up, download it again. They really want to make it as flexible as possible. They even have an Android and iOS app called the Lookups app that will help you look up individual addresses easily. Make sure you've got it right. And you'll love if you're crafting software for data entry for customer service reps or for shopping carts, there's a great API and you can incorporate Melissa right into that software, because really that's where a lot of this errors go in, is at the point of entry, right? 240 plus countries and territories right there at the point of entry can be verified, fixed. If duplicate information, another big waste of time and money. Melissa's global address verification service has data matching that'll eliminate clutter and duplicates and increase the accuracy of your database. You could do it as a batch. You could do it onesie twosie. You could do it as it's entered. It's also great. Shopping carts will like this for identity verification, which reduces risk, ensures compliance, keeps customers happy. You can add geocoding in. This is popular, where it takes an address and gives you a longitude and latitude. You can remove up to 95% of bad email addresses from your database, replace them with good ones. Melissa's pretty amazing. And, of course, you're giving them important stuff, so they want to reassure you they are absolutely committed to your data security, to privacy, completely compliant. They're SOC 2, HIPAA, GDPR compliant, so you can use them with confidence. And by the way, they don't just say that. They undergo continuous third-party security audits to make sure they're living up to their promise to you to keep your information absolutely secure and private. Melissa's industry-leading products and services empower improved business communications, more profitable customer relationships, and give you a competitive advantage. And if you sign up for a service-level agreement, you'll love the 24/7 world-famous Melissa support. Warm, friendly, helpful. They just go above and beyond. In fact, they're often acknowledged for this. Second year in a row now, they've been named to the Data Quality Magic Quadrant by Gartner. G2's 2022 report. And G2 Crowd ranks Melissa as a leader in both address verification and data quality software. So I hope you understand the need to keep your customer data up to date. And I hope you understand Melissa is the place to do it. You can even try Melissa's APIs if you want to. They've got a developer portal. You can log on, sign up, start playing in the sandbox for free 24/7. In fact, they'll go through 1,000 records for free. So you can pump some stuff at them. And they'll clean it up automatically for free. Melissa, M-E-L-I-S-S-A, melissa.com/twit. We thank them so much for supporting Security Now. Thank you for supporting Security Now by using that address so they know you saw it here. melissa.com/twit. Sometimes it's confusing, I understand. Sometimes advertisers want you to put Security Now. Sometimes we try to convince advertisers, just use twit so it's the same. And you'll know who, you know, based on when your ad runs, who saw it when. So thank you, Melissa. They're going to make it easy for you. Just melissa.com/twit. But they'll know that you saw it here. Back to Steve Gibson and more security.
As I start to describe this latest attack, I have to conclude that the bad guys really do have an advantage. you know, they're able to sit back and steeple their fingers with a faraway look in their eyes. Exactly. While they endlessly cook up one sneaky way after another to bend the technology we've innocently given them to their dastardly purposes. Today, we had the latest attack concept that's been named Browser in the Browser. It's, you know, it could have been done before, but it just occurred to a pen testing guy. It's a novel new form of phishing attack, which was designed and documented by a pen tester who goes by the handle Mr. Docs. It's obvious once you see it, but it would not be obvious to a user who were to encounter it when they're expecting to see it. It's able to perfectly and convincingly simulate the pop-up browser window that we're all encountering more and more often with the spread of those third-party, you know, single sign-on options embedded on websites, you know, the sign-in with Google or Facebook or Apple or Microsoft, whatever. I got two screenshots side by side, which this guy produced, demonstrating that there's no way to tell them apart. You know, with page rendering, which allows JavaScript, CSS, and HTML to perfectly recreate the appearance of a legitimate sign-in with whomever pop-up dialogue, you know, an innocent user has no idea. And Mr. Docs notes that one of the things that makes this attack so effective is that the spoofed dialogue clearly and prominently displays the exactly correct domain name, the verification of which we've been drilling into our users for years, you know, saying, make sure you're at the right site. Double check the URL for any typos or lookalike characters. You know, don't be fooled. Well, you know, then along comes this perfect replica of a third-party sign-in dialogue that accepts their innocently entered username and password. And because the JavaScript just printed a fake URL at the top of the dialogue, which is where they're expecting.
Oh, I see.
You know, it's
easy.
It's
I understand it's easy to duplicate the login screen. That's just, it's all open. It's JavaScript and HTML. I get it. So instead of where the browser puts the URL, you just put a graphic.
Yep.
That looks the same. And how would you know unless you clicked it? I guess if you clicked it, you might not be able to click the padlock, for instance. I don't know. Well, that's interesting. Wow.
Isn't it? I mean, and again,
of course.
Easy. You click on, you know, sign in with Facebook, up this thing pops, and you think, oh, I mean, you're expecting it. And so you may be doing due diligence. You go, okay, wait, facebook.com. Yep, that's Facebook. Nope.
Wow.
So, and Leo, just because Mr. Docs. I couldn't remember if it was Dr. Docs or not.
Dr. Docs would be better, but I guess he didn't get his degree.
Yeah. Anyway, Mr. Docs. To avoid any unnecessary duplication of effort, Mr. Docs has thoughtfully provided attacker-ready, easy-to-use, downloadable templates.
It even has dark mode.
That's right. You got your dark mode. You got your light mode. You got your Chrome on Windows or Mac OS. Whatever you need, just get it from GitHub.
Yeah, so you can't really just say, look at the URL anymore.
Nope.
I do wonder, though, what would happen. I guess you could write some JavaScript that if you clicked the padlock, you'd get something else, but
probably another little thing that says, it's all good.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the attacker has control of the window, so it can do whatever you want. I mean, it's a fake URL, so fake the click on the padlock. Yeah, and actually, since we were talking about Squirrel, this already occurred to us back then, and a lot of attention was given to designing a pop-up dialogue that could not be spoofed in this fashion. So, again, we did a lot of work at the time. But, yeah, wow. I just, you know, look what we've done to poor users. It's just
I'm sorry.
You know, no wonder your mom says, Leo, how do I dot, dot, dot?
What's going on? By the way,
and of course,
I know you're not reading the Bobo verse. You're not listening to it as an audiobook. You're reading it. But Ray Porter reading it does all the voices. He does Homer. Not a great Homer, but he does
it. No kidding.
Yeah.
Oh.
So there's he's doing a lot of good voices in there. It's pretty funny. He does.
Wow.
Colonel Butterworth, he does perfectly. It's very funny. Anyway, sorry, didn't mean to distract. Yeah, this is crazy. What do we tell people now? You know, we always said make sure it's the right URL. You have to manually enter it, but that's not going to work for an authentication window.
No. And well, look at the stuff that follows it. It's like I used to joke. I had one of my best friends was a lot older than I. He has since passed, but his name was Gary. I used to joke that the Windows. What is that key we type in? The five groups of five. I forgot what you call that. Anyway,
the serial number, you mean? Yeah, yeah.
And
you had to type it in.
Yes.
Oh, the license key.
The license key. I used to joke that it was the equivalent of copyright protection.
Oh, terrible.
Because he was never able to get it right.
Remember, we had to type that in. That was crazy.
Oh, yeah. He'd be looking at it going, okay, JQ5PT. Yeah. And I go, Gary, no, that's an 8. But anyway, look at URLs. URLs used to be, they were supposed to be meaningful. Now they've got these GUIDs in them that's just gibberish. So, yeah, you can't ask a user to type that.
Yeah.
They never get logged in. They just go away. So, wow. Okay. Last Wednesday, Microsoft blogged under the title Uncovering TrickBot's Use of IoT Devices in Command and Control Infrastructure. Microsoft considers MikroTik consumer routers to be IoT devices. That's, how they lump them. And I suppose since they lack a keyboard or display and they're, by definition connected to the internet, they qualify as Internet of Things. So Microsoft offered an interesting forensic write-up, which I'll share the best bit of. They begin with a bit of history. They said, TrickBot, a sophisticated Trojan that has evolved significantly since its discovery in 2016, has continually expanded its capabilities and, even with disruption efforts and news of its infrastructure going offline, it has managed to remain one of the most persistent threats in recent years. The malware's modular nature has allowed it to be increasingly adaptable to different networks, environments, and devices. In addition, it has grown to include numerous plugins, access as a service backdoors for other malware like Ryuk ransomware, and mining capabilities. A significant part of its evolution also includes making its attacks and infrastructure more durable. And that's where we're headed here, against detection, including continuously improving its persistence capabilities, evading researchers and reverse engineering, and finding new ways to maintain the stability of its command and control framework. This continuous evolution has seen TrickBot expand its reach from computers to Internet of Things devices such as routers, with the malware updating its command and control infrastructure to utilize MikroTik devices and modules. MikroTik routers are widely used around the world across different industries. By using MikroTik routers as proxy servers for its command and control servers and redirecting the traffic through non-standard ports, TrickBot adds another persistence layer that helps malicious IPs evade detection by standard security systems, meaning that a security system might be banning connections to a known malicious IP, so no problem. Let's have TrickBot bounce its traffic through some random MikroTik router that's not going to be banned, and then it will send its traffic on to the command and control server, thus serving as a proxy. Okay, so when Microsoft says that MikroTik routers are being used as command and control proxies using non-standard ports, they mean that once they've managed to crawl inside, they, the bad guys, inside a MikroTik router, and we'll discuss exactly how that happens in a minute, they set up a proxy server, or actually the equivalent, it's actually just persistent NAT, that's listening on one or more non-standard ports for incoming command and control queries from instances of TrickBot out in the field. This provides the attackers with much more isolation and resilience than if all instances of TrickBot were phoning home directly. You know, we've all seen the movies where tracing the traffic is thwarted by having it bouncing around among various intermediaries in widely geographically spread jurisdictions. And also, assuming that there's a sufficient available inventory of vulnerable MikroTik devices, and we'll talk about that in a minute, apparently that's not a problem, having different instances of deployed TrickBots connecting to widely dispersed MikroTik proxies makes finding the actual command and control servers much more difficult, and it makes the TrickBot botnet much more difficult to take down. Okay, so Microsoft said the Microsoft Defender for IoT research team has recently discovered the exact method through which MikroTik devices are used in TrickBox command and control infrastructure. In this blog, we'll share our analysis of the method and provide insights on how attackers gain access to MikroTik devices and use compromised IoT devices, meaning these MikroTik boxes, in TrickBot attacks. This analysis has enabled us to develop a forensic tool to identify TrickBot-related compromise and other suspicious indicators on MikroTik devices. We published this tool to help customers ensure these IoT devices are not susceptible to these attacks. We're also sharing recommended steps for detecting and remediating compromise if found, as well as general prevention steps to protect against future attacks. Now, I'm not going to go into all that because, you know, it's just sort of down in the weeds and only applies to people who have these routers. And if you've got a MikroTik router, just update it. Make sure it's running the latest firmware and that you're not using default passwords, because there are three ways Microsoft has detected attackers gaining an initial foothold on these MikroTik routers. They will first attempt to gain access using default MikroTik passwords. It turns out that the old lesson has still not been learned, and that MikroTik's design wrongly provides for remote access under default credentials, which is just hard to believe in this day and age. As we know, default credentials, if any must exist, should never also be allowed to be used to enable remote authentication from the WAN interface. Any user wishing to enable WAN side remote admin, maybe after first passing a sanity test. Why? Well, why do you want to do this? Are you really sure? It's really not a good idea. Anyway, should be required to create non-default credentials. Not doing this, not requiring this, is incredibly poor security design in this day and age. Well, really ever. But now, how do you excuse it? Okay. So, Microsoft said it will that they these bad guys will first try using the default credentials. If that fails, then a brute force credential, so-called credential stuffing attack, is attempted. Microsoft wrote that they have seen attackers using unique passwords that were probably harvested from other possibly related MikroTik devices. You know, hey, you know, it's worth a shot. Why not? And then, believe it or not, and, oh yeah, I know we all believe it, by exploiting CVE 2018, 14847, a well-known and long-since-patched four-year-old vulnerability which will succeed on devices still running router OS versions older than 6.42, there's another way in. This vulnerability, which we covered back when it was news at the time, 4 years ago, gives an attacker the ability to read arbitrary files from a remote MikroTik router. Specifically, a handy file, such as user.dat, which contains the passwords. And once in, they then change the router's password to retain control. Since any such router is probably long forgotten, that is to say, a router that hasn't had its firmware updated in 4 years, is long forgotten, probably tucked away in some dark corner or a closet with a sign on the door which reads, "Don't mess with anything in here," it's unlikely that anyone will be inconvenienced by having their router's password unilaterally changed by some remote hacker, let alone having it commandeered for use as a botnet command and control proxy. The attackers then use the handy-dandy MikroTik command that redirects traffic between two external ports on the router, thus enabling and establishing a line of communication between TrickBot-infected systems and TrickBot's command and control. Or perhaps another indirect link in the command and control chain if they want to be more fancy, like in the movies. MikroTik has a router OS containing very powerful SSH-accessible IP firewall and NAT stacks. It's this unique, remotely accessible static NAT capability that makes MikroTik routers so useful as unattended communications proxies. Microsoft says that they monitored a TrickBot-infected device connecting to a MikroTik router over port 449, after which the MikroTik router connected to a TrickBot command and control server over port 80. And, as for today's inventory of MikroTik routers, a relatively recent report by Eclipsium, published this last December, found that, quote, hundreds of thousands of MikroTik routers are still vulnerable to remote exploitation, despite patches having been available for them for years. And because these devices feature unusually powerful hardware, which is why they're so popular, they're seen as high-value targets. Back in early December of last year, 2021, when covering this report from Eclipsium, our friends over at Bleeping Computer reached out to MikroTik for some comment about the sad state of their otherwise very nice and quite powerful routers updating. MikroTik replied, quote, "The Eclipsium report deals with the same old vulnerabilities we have mentioned in our previous security blogs."
Well, exactly.
As far as we...
Yes.
Yep.
This problem has been here since 2018.
As far as we know, they said, there are no new vulnerabilities in router OS. Furthermore, router OS has been recently independently audited by several third parties. They all arrived at the same conclusion. Unfortunately, they wrote, publishing updated firmware does not immediately protect the affected routers. We don't have an illegal backdoor to change the user's password and check their firewall or their configuration. These steps must be taken by the users themselves. We try our best to reach out to all users of router OS and remind them to do software updates, use secure passwords, check their firewall to restrict remote access to unfamiliar parties, and look for unusual scripts. Unfortunately, many users have never been in contact with MikroTik and are not actively monitoring their devices. We cooperate with various institutions worldwide to look for other solutions as well. Meanwhile, they finish, we want to stress the importance of keeping your router OS installation up to date once again. That is the essential step to avoid all kinds of vulnerabilities.
Yes.
So,
true.
Yes. It is absolutely true. And I suppose we might be more sympathetic if they didn't also, apparently, have a default password that allows users to log in remotely.
This has been covered before, again and again. Why are you bringing this up, Steve? We know that.
We don't know that it might have been changed in their recent later releases, but again, so what? What may have once started off as fiction in the movies is actually underway today. All of those, hopping five times around the globe before finally connecting to the mothership, and it's like, oh, we don't have access into all those other geographies. So, oh well. Yet, there are hundreds of thousands of these things out there right now.
Hundreds.
Unbelievable.
Amazing.
Okay, this one's cool. You're going to like this one, Leo. A new and moderately severe problem has been discovered in all supported versions of OpenSSL. Now, it's officially being called a high severity problem. But since problems in OpenSSL can be so much worse than an infinite loop, I think it's more likely of moderate severity. Nevertheless, especially in today's current climate with, increased cyber hostilities, it does seem destined to be exploited because it is so powerful, so ubiquitous, and so easy to exploit. The reason is that any internet server or service running any internet protocol whose security is being provided by OpenSSL, as most Unix, Linux, and a great many cloud-based services are, OpenSSL is the default TLS connection provider for our Linuxes, for example, that any of those that has not just in the last week received update patches and been updated, as many internet servers will not have been yet, which consumes a user-provided certificate, such as a client certificate, can be taken down with a simple, deliberately crafted TLS handshake. The trouble was discovered and reported by Google's Tavis Ormandy, who reported his findings to the OpenSSL team on the 24th of February last month. The trouble Tavis found and worked out with David Benjamin, Chrome's TLS guy, is that a modular square root function named bn_mod_sqrt, if provided with a maliciously crafted certificate to parse, will enter an infinite loop, thus pegging the processor at 100% and permanently hanging that thread. The CVE write-up of this problem is interesting. It explains, it says, the BN mod square root function, which computes a modular square root, contains a bug that can cause it to loop forever for non-prime moduli. Internally, this function is used when parsing certificates that contain elliptic curve public keys in compressed form, or elliptic curve parameters with a base point encoded in compressed form. It is possible to trigger the infinite loop by crafting a certificate that has invalid explicit curve parameters. Since certificate parsing happens prior to verification of the certificate's signature, any process that parses an externally supplied certificate may thus be subject to a denial of service attack. Okay, in other words, since the certificate's signature is checked for validity after the exploitable parameters are processed. Anyone can trivially create a certificate that will completely lock up anything that's using OpenSSL. Their description continues. The infinite loop can also be reached when parsing crafted private keys, as they can contain explicit elliptic curve parameters. Thus, the vulnerable situations include, and this is from the CVE write-up, TLS clients consuming server certificates, TLS servers consuming client certificates, hosting providers taking certificates or private keys from customers, certificate authorities parsing certificate requests from subscribers, anything else which parses ASN.1 elliptic curve parameters, and any other applications that use the BN mod square root, where the attacker can control the parameter values that are vulnerable to this DDoS or this DOS issue. In the earliest OpenSSL 1.0.2 version, the public key is not parsed during the initial parsing of the certificate, which makes it slightly harder to trigger the infinite loop. However, any operation which requires the public key from the certificate will trigger the infinite loop. In particular, the attacker can use a self-signed certificate, for example, to trigger the loop during verification of the certificate signature. So you got to sign the certificate rather than not care about the signature. Big deal. The issue affects OpenSSL versions 1.0.2, 1.1.1, and 3.0. It was addressed in the release of 1.1.1N and 3.0.2 on the 15th of March, so last week. That was exactly a week ago, last Tuesday. So it's fixed in OpenSSL 3.0.2, which fixed the affected versions 3.0.0 and 3.0.1, and was fixed in OpenSSL 1.1.1N, which affected everything 1.1.1 up through 1.1.1M. So again, note that OpenSSL 1.0.2, which is vulnerable, has reached end of life and is not being actively supported. So users are advised, if anybody still has 1.0.2, to upgrade to a new release branch as soon as possible, because this one is not going to be fixed publicly. And note also that many critical infrastructure-ish things routinely make use of certificate-based mutual authentication, where each of the two endpoints provides an identity-asserting and assuring certificate as a means for securely establishing their identities to each other. You know, not just IP addresses, but, you know, let's swap certs. And, you know, Leo, you and I were always talking about a cert being the right way to authenticate an SSH connection. So, you know, it's like that. Therefore, any such system with listening ports exposed to the public internet, despite its administrators being sure that it will only connect to other endpoints which provide the proper matching certificate or expected certificate, are immediately vulnerable to being taken down by anyone else on the public internet. Not surprisingly, this has all generated a great deal of interest, and GitHub has been buzzing. And all the work has been done with someone else using the handle catbro666, providing a working proof of concept certificate which will take down any unpatched instance of OpenSSL that makes the mistake of accepting any such certificate. The hosting processor is pinned, as I said, at 100% utilization, and nothing else gets done. So far, there are no confirmed indications of this thing being exploited. But for this one, it's more, you know, a matter of when, not whether. There was one report of the Italian cert posting that this had been seen in exploitation, but my guess is that was a mistake, since it, you know, there was only one one-off instance of that being alerted. So probably nothing to worry about. But again, you know, if you're using OpenSSL and your system will accept a cert from somebody, you want to make sure that you update it. And this is only a week old. Okay, this is really cool. CISA alert AA22-074A. I want to share an interesting CISA alert, which details a Russian state-supported attack upon an NGO, a non-governmental organization, because it contains some interesting and quite specific forensic detail from their investigation, and may have some useful takeaways for some of our listeners. CISA's alert is titled, Russian State-Sponsored Cyber Actors Gain Network Access by Exploiting Default Multi-Factor Authentication Protocols and Print Nightmare Vulnerability. So CISA's report opens with a summary. They said the Federal Bureau of Investigation and Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, are releasing this joint cyber security advisory to warn organizations that Russian state-supported cyber actors have gained network access through exploitation of default MFA protocols and a known vulnerability. As early as May 2021, Russian state-sponsored cyber actors took advantage of a misconfigured account set to default MFA protocols at a non-governmental organization, allowing them to enroll a new device for MFA and access the victim network. The actors then exploited a critical Windows print spooler vulnerability, imagine that, Print Nightmare, to run arbitrary code with system privileges. Russian state-sponsored cyber actors successfully exploited the vulnerability while targeting an NGO using Cisco's Duo MFA, enabling access to cloud and email accounts for document exfiltration. This advisory provides observed tactics, techniques, and procedures, indicators of compromise, IOCs, and recommendations to protect against Russian state-sponsored malicious cyber activity. FBI and CISA urge all organizations to apply the recommendations in the mitigation section of the advisory. Okay, so here are some of the interesting details of this attack, which were uncovered during its investigation. They said, as early as May 2021, the FBI observed Russian state-sponsored cyber actors gain access to an NGO, exploit a flaw in default MFA protocols, and move laterally to the NGO's cloud environment. They said Russian state-supported cyber actors gained initial access to the victim organization via compromised credentials and enrolling a new device in, meaning, you know, computer, or I guess it could have been a handheld, in the organization's Duo MFA. The actors gained the credentials via brute force password guessing attack, allowing them access to a victim account with a simple, predictable password. Okay, so they're calling it brute force, but apparently not much brute was needed, or force for that matter, if it was, you know, a predictable password. Okay, so now we're in. The victim account had been unenrolled from Duo due to a long period of inactivity, but it was not disabled in Active Directory. As Duo's default configuration settings allow for re-enrollment of a new device for dormant accounts, the actors were able to enroll a new device for this account, complete the authentication requirements, and obtain access to the victim network. Okay, now, first of all, I'll just mention, because I don't mention it later, that's a bad default, right? But it's not the worst default, as we'll see in a minute. But this says that if an account is dormant and stops being supported, just using it again without needing to do anything else brings Duo's support for multi-factor authentication on that dormant account back to life. Doesn't have to be that way, but it's the default. They said, using the compromised account, Russian state-sponsored cyber actors performed privilege escalation via exploitation of the print nightmare vulnerability to obtain administrator privileges. And again, this is another reminder. You know, it's easy to think of remote code execution attacks as being, or remote code execution vulnerabilities as being really bad, but we keep seeing that bad guys are able to get in as an unprivileged user. You do not want them to be able to elevate that privilege to admin. Anyway, Print Nightmare made it possible. The actors also modified a domain controller file. Get this. /Windows/System32/Drivers/etc/Hosts. If anyone who's familiar with the Windows directory layout knows that that's where Windows hosts file lives, and it is still there and still effective to this day. And we may remember a little anecdote that I got caught out when the credit card processing service backend that we use changed their IP address, and I had stuck their IP address in my GRC's server's host file, and I couldn't figure out why isn't DNS like working? Well, I overwrote it in the hosts file, as one can. Anyway, these guys modified a domain controller file, the domain controller's host file, thus redirecting Duo multi-factor authentication calls to localhost instead of where it would normally go, the Duo server. This change prevented the multi-factor authentication service from contacting its server to validate MFA login.
So it failed, of course, right? And locked you out.
It failed, of course. This effectively disabled multi-factor authentication for active domain accounts because the default policy of Duo for Windows is to fail open.
I remember Bruce Schneier talking about how many enterprise tools fail open, including firewalls.
Leo, it's like, we wouldn't want to inconvenience anybody, especially not a Russian attacker.
Well, yes, exactly.
That would be an inconvenience.
Why slow them down? That's why I'm putting on my hoodie. I'm getting ready. Wow.
I know.
A lot. This is a real problem because a lot of supposedly very secure places use Duo.
Okay, yes, exactly. So, and then as if to apologize for mentioning this, CISA added, note, fail open can happen to any MFA implementation and is not exclusive to Duo. Okay, but since the tyranny of the default is one of this podcast's core observations, I was curious about Cisco's default for their Duo MFA. And sure enough, in an FAQ over at Duo.com, in answer to the question, how can I configure the fail mode, Duo replies, quote, by default, Duo authentication for Windows login will fail open and permit the Windows logon to continue if it is unable to contact the Duo service. You can set the fail mode during installation to fail closed.
Oh.
During installation.
But it's not the default.
No. By deselecting the bypass Duo authentication when offline box during installation. Okay.
But that's as if your two-factor authenticator You don't have the coat? That's fine. Go on in. It's so dumb.
Exactly. It's now, and if an admin is installing this for the first time and you don't yet know it all well, so you're going to leave all of the presumably recommended defaults alone.
Sure, right.
At least for the time being.
Yeah.
We've all been there, right? So is there any reminder in the UI that that's the way it was set? No. Okay? But it's easy to change that later, right? No. Since they're answering the question, how can I configure the fail mode, meaning that presumably it's not obvious, thus needing to be answered in the product's FAQ, Duo then proceeds to explain, quote, to change the fail mode after installation, use the registry editor.
Redunit.exe. What? Oh, you can set it.
Yeah. Yeah, we provide a key. We provide a key for that. Just dig down 12 layers in the registry.
What? Oh, my
With
God.
Admin privileges, of course, to create or update, they say, the following registry value. Okay, wow. So, not really the secure by default operation that you'd expect from an add-on multi-factor authentication system whose entire purpose is to meaningfully increase the system's security.
Yes.
After all, as you said, Leo, this system is now inconveniencing everyone all the time, you know, by having it, except the Russians, who simply bypassed it strategic advantage of Duo's well-known default fail open policy. So I wanted to bring this up in case any of our listeners work with companies using Cisco's Duo MFA.
I do.
It might be worth having your IT admin check out the current setting of that registry key. Anyway, I've included a link to the FAQ item in question in the show notes. Anyway, CISA continues, after effectively disabling multi-factor authentication, Russian state-sponsored cyber actors were able to successfully authenticate to the victim's virtual private network as a non-administrator user and make remote desktop protocol connections to Windows domain controllers. Mm. The actors ran commands to obtain credentials for additional domain accounts, then used the method described in the previous paragraph, changed the MFA configuration file, and bypassed multi-factor authentication for these newly created and compromised accounts. The actors leveraged mostly internal Windows utilities already present, remember, living off the land, within the victim network to perform this activity. Using these compromised accounts without MFA enforced, Russian state-sponsored cyber actors were able to move laterally to the victim's cloud storage and email accounts and access desired content. And for those who aren't clear about the nature of NGOs, you know, the target of this attack, you know, they're typically benign, nonprofit, explicitly unaffiliated with any particular government. You know, a few examples of NGOs would be Greenpeace International, CARE, the World Wildlife Fund, and Doctors Without Borders. CISA doesn't tell us which NGO was targeted in this instance, but, you know, Russia knows. Wow. Then we have the Windows local privilege escalation. Speaking of local privilege escalations that Microsoft seems unable to fix. This is the, believe it or not, ongoing saga of a Windows flaw that Microsoft paradoxically appears to be unable to fix. Since there's no obvious reason why this particular problem should be beyond them, one must conclude, again, as we have been with increasing frequency lately, that they just really don't care, or that something has gone very wrong somewhere deep inside. This all begins way back last August of 2021, with an elevation of privilege vulnerability in the Windows User Profile Service. Back then, it was tracked as CVE-2021-34484 after having been discovered by a security researcher named Abdulhamid Nasiri. And if his name seems familiar, it's because the problem he found just won't go away. And we've been following. And it's not a small problem. It's a, as I said, a local privilege escalation which allows unprivileged users, like those pesky Ruskies, who manage to gain access, to then acquire valuable administrative privileges in Windows 10, 11, and the latest version of Windows Server. It has a CVSS of 7.8. And although exploits have been publicly disclosed, thus, by Microsoft's own definition, it's a zero day for them, no evidence has yet been found of its exploitation in the wild, or any sincere, or for that matter, any sincere attempt on Microsoft's part to actually fix it. No discovery. It was originally said to be fixed, as I noted, as part of August 2021's Patch Tuesday. But Nasiri became curious after those patches were published and pushed out to see how Microsoft had fixed what he had found. What he now found back then was that Microsoft had not fixed the problem. Instead, it was another one of those address the symptom, not the problem, pseudo fixes. So, Nasiri presented another proof of concept which bypassed Microsoft's non-fix across all Windows desktop and server versions. And spoiler alert, that remains true today. It was at this point that our friends over at Zero Patch, the guys who create those wonderful little itty-bitty micro-patches which fix problems that Microsoft hasn't yet, or can't, or won't, decided to release one of their own unofficial patches for all Windows versions, making it free for all their registered users. Apparently not being in any huge hurry to fix this after their August fail, the first time they checked this off their fixed list, Microsoft finally responded to the second bypass in their January of this year, 2022, Patch Tuesday. And they updated its CVE, for some reason, to 2022-21919, marking it again as fixed. And again, believe it or not, it wasn't, and today still isn't. Once again, Nasiri found a way to bypass Microsoft's second attempt and noted that this one was even worse than the first. Happily, that original micropatch still worked. But March's, this just 2 weeks ago, update 2 weeks ago, changed the DLL in question, which is prof, as in profile, P-R-O-F-E-X-T dot DLL, which broke Zero Patch's micropatch. So not only did Microsoft's March update still not resolve the problem, but it also removed the third-party protection that Zero Patch users had been enjoying until then. Undaunted, Zero Patch has updated its micropatch so that its users are once again protected while we presumably wait for Microsoft to yet again try to actually fix the problem. And in one last bit of happy news, users of Windows 10 editions 1803, 1809, and 2004 have remained safely protected by Zero Patch's original patch, since those Windows editions have reached the end of their support life and were therefore spared from receiving Microsoft's update, which re-exposed everyone else to the problem. Yes, that's what makes the security industry and the computer industry so interesting.
I could fix
kind
that
of nonsense
again and again.
Wow, Leo. So I'm going to sip some water. You're going to tell
right.
our listeners
okay. mm-hmm.
why we're here. And then we're going to talk about use after free and what why it just keeps being such a problem.
Good. I'm looking forward to that. It's going to be interesting. We talk a lot about garbage collection. I imagine that will
be involved in the subject.
In fact, we get the abbreviation GC.
GC. I'm wearing a hoodie because I'm on the black team. I'm not on the red team. I'm not on the blue team. I'm on the hoodie team. I'm coming to get you. That's why you need PlexTrack, the purple teaming platform. I guess we can't say black hat anymore. I'm just a bad guy. Can we say that? I'm a bad guy. Bad hoodie. Security Now is brought to you by PlexTrack, the proactive cybersecurity management platform. If you're ready for the benefits of purple teaming, but you don't know how to get started, this is the place to go. If you want to work to ensure your security posture and you're struggling to optimize efficiency to facilitate cooperation and collaboration within your team, I've got a great solution for you, PlexTrack. It's the powerful but easy to use. In fact, it makes your life easier, cybersecurity platform. It centralizes all your security assessments, all your pen test reports, your audit findings, your vulnerability tracking. It transforms the risk management lifecycle. It means security teams can generate better reports faster. If using templates, among other things, you can even have drag and drop from your various testing apps. You can aggregate and visualize analytics. And then when it comes time to go to the blue team and say, let's fix this thing, you can collaborate on remediation in the PlexTrack platform in real time. It's a collaborative platform, and that's really the best way to solve these thorny security issues. The PlexTrack platform addresses pain points across the entire spectrum of security team workflows and roles. I'll give you a couple of them. There's many modules, but for example, the reports module I was mentioning, this is great because you can put in code samples, you can put in screenshots, you can add videos. Here I am standing in front of the server. It's broken. If you want, you can import findings from all the major scanning tools. I'm being silly. You can export to custom templates. So if you're doing something again and again, and you are, aren't you, with a click of a button, that template pops up, you repopulate it. I'm being silly, but honestly, all of those visual features really enhance your communication with stakeholders, your board, your CEO, your CISO, your CIO. And communication is part of what this is all about. You'll love the Runbooks module if you're the red team, because you can use it to facilitate your tabletop exercises and your red team engagements. You could do breach and attack simulations. It's kind of like that big D&D book, you know, the Dungeon Master has, with all of the rules in it, but it's all automated. It's automatic. It'll also help you with your purple teaming activities, so your communication and collaboration is facilitated. It upgrades your program's capabilities by making the most of every team member, every tool. And this is really important, because I suspect we're really talking to the team members here on this show. It's going to make your life better, your life easier. Easier to communicate, easier to get your job done, easier to get the fixes done. And that's really why you're there, isn't it? Analytics module, you'll love this. It'll help you visualize your security posture. You can quickly assess and prioritize, which will help you create a more effective workflow. You can map risks to frameworks like MITRE ATT&CK to create a risk register. Really, you're getting the idea that this is all about kind of facilitating and automating the stuff that you're doing day in, day out. Eliminating the repetitive so you can really focus on getting the job done. Enterprise security teams use PlexTrack to streamline their pen tests and security assessments and incidents response reports and much more, keeping the red and the blue teams focused on getting the real security work done. With PlexTrack, you'll gain precious time back in your team's day, and you'll improve employee morale. I'll give you an example. There's a lot of testimonials on the site, but this one from an enterprise customer, Jacobs Engineering. They said, quote, deploying PlexTrack allowed our team to cut the reporting cycle by 65%. And I can guarantee you that 65% was busy work. It wasn't about getting the job done. It was about typing. And by eliminating all of that tedious, time-consuming work, you're more effective. You're getting the job done. You're communicating better. You're collaborating better. I want you to book a demo today to see how much time PlexTrack can save your team, how much pain it can eliminate from your day-to-day life. Try PlexTrack free for 1 month and see how it can improve the effectiveness and efficiency of your security team. And if I'm talking to the stakeholders and not the security team, don't worry. It's not going to make their life easier. It's going to make your life easier. They don't care about you. It's going to make your life easier. You're going to like it. Simply go to plextrack.com/twit. PLEXTRAC. Plextrack.com/twit. You probably heard about this. If you certainly heard me talking about it, get your free month. Get your demo. You're going to love it. I guarantee you. PLEXTRAC.com/TWIT. Use that address to let them know that you saw it here. Plextrack.com/twit. We thank Plextrack so much for all they do for security teams, blue and red and purple across the board. And thank them for supporting Steve's work. I'm pointing it the wrong way. You're not over there. You're over there. Steve's work on security now. Well, you're truthfully in this studio. You're everywhere. You're on monitor. Everywhere. All right. Let's talk about the garbage collection and use after free, which sounds kind of sexy, actually. I don't know. What is use after free?
So today's nominal podcast topic was inspired by several pieces, as I mentioned at the top, of recent listener feedback. And it was a tweet from Stephen Belchester that finally caused me to decide to give this a bit more time. Stephen tweeted, "It would be good if you could clarify your comments about use after free vulnerabilities in Firefox," he said, parens, "and similar ones in previous weeks." He said, "You've said a few times that use after free issues are being caused by memory management being done automatically by the language. That implied, to me at least, that the language that Firefox is written in is memory managed and causing the issues, which seemed pretty unlikely to me. After some further digging, it seems like the issue is actually with Firefox's automatic memory management that runs underneath the HTML, CSS, JavaScript stack." Okay, so first of all, if I didn't say it, I would have meant that memory management is being performed by the language's runtime.
But you could have a use after free if you malloc something and deallocate it. And then call it. You can do it to yourself. Yes. It doesn't have to be an automatic tool.
That is exactly right. And in fact, I will get to that sort of non-automatic issue in a second. But the attacks that we see being leveraged are generally the implementation of JavaScript. And JavaScript is famously a language with automatic background garbage collection. And although, unfortunately, we have a name collision here, we made it very clear long time ago that Java, the language, and JavaScript have, nothing in common, right? But Java, the language, is a perfect example, both because being a virtual machine-based language, there's the Java JVM, Java, the language, has a clear runtime environment. And because it's famous for having a very powerful garbage collector. In looking around for some examples, I found a web page titled "How Java Garbage Collection Works." And it starts off saying, "Java memory management, with its built-in garbage collection, is one of the language's finest achievements. It allows developers to create new objects without worrying explicitly about memory allocation and deallocation, because the garbage collector automatically reclaims memory for reuse. This enables faster development with less boilerplate code, while eliminating memory leaks and other memory-related problems, then it says, at least in theory. Ironically, Java garbage collection seems to work too well, creating and removing too many objects. Most memory management issues are solved, but often at the cost of creating serious performance problems. Making garbage collection adaptable to all kinds of situations has led to a complex and hard-to-optimize system. To wrap your head around garbage collection, you need first to understand how memory management works in a Java virtual machine." And we're not going to get into that because the rest of that page goes into a lengthy treatise on Java's memory management. The task of sweeping out the garbage, memory garbage, has been the topic of a great many academic papers. And I've found, to my I guess, not surprised, but I thought it was interesting that Amazon lists two books dedicated solely to the subject. There's The Garbage Collection Handbook, colon, yes, The Art of Automatic Memory Management, and that says, parens, Applied Algorithms and Data Structures, unquote. And then we have Garbage Collection, colon, Algorithms for Automatic Dynamic Memory Management. And I thought the back flap of that one was interesting. It says, the memory storage requirements of complex programs are extremely difficult to manage correctly by hand. A single error, like what you were talking about, Leo, may lead to indeterminate and inexplicable program crashes.
Often worse, does.
Yes.
Very common.
Worse still. And in fact, that's what you want, actually, is
yeah,
a crash.
Yeah, you wish it would crash. Yeah.
Exactly. And then you can begin to track it down. And the flap says, worse still, failures are often unrepeatable, oops, and may surface only long after the program has been delivered to the customer.
Yeah.
The eradication of memory errors typically consumes a substantial amount of development time. And yet the answer is relatively easy. Garbage collection. Removing the clutter of memory management from module interfaces, which then frees the programmer to concentrate on the problem at hand rather than low-level bookkeeping details. For this reason, most modern object-oriented languages such as Smalltalk, Eiffel, Java, and Dylan, and of course JavaScript, are supported by garbage collection.
Okay, you could tell how old this book is by those choices of languages.
Yes. Okay. Dylan? Hello, Dylan.
Smalltalk and Eiffel? Okay.
Smalltalk,
yeah.
Right.
They are garbage collected. That's true, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, I think it was 1991, maybe.
Yeah, I can tell, yeah.
Says garbage collecting libraries are even available for such uncooperative languages as C and C++. Hmm. This book considers how dynamic memory can be recycled automatically to guarantee error-free memory management. There is an abundant but disparate literature on the subject, largely confined to research papers. This book sets out to pool this experience in a single, accessible, and unified framework. Visit this book's companion website, which I'll be surprised if it's still around, for updates, revisions, online GC resources, bibliography, and links to more GC sites. And, speaking of the devil, Dr. Dobbs Journal reviewed the book.
Oh, yeah. Running light without overbite. Oh, yeah.
That's right.
Yep.
They said whatever else Java has accomplished, it has finally brought garbage collection into the mainstream. The efficiency and correctness of garbage collection algorithms is henceforth going to be of concern to hundreds of thousands of programmers. Those who really care about this could do no better than to start with garbage collection, algorithms for automatic memory, dynamic memory management.
Wow.
The sort of comprehensive engineering manual that is so rare in computing.
Just before we go too much farther, just so people know why this is important. Almost always when you're doing a computer, let's say you're creating an array or you've got a database, you're going to allocate some memory to store this stuff in, operate on it, and then when you're done, deallocate it. If you don't deallocate it, eventually memory fills up. That's called a memory leak, and you crash. So you've got to deallocate it. And there are really only three different ways to do it. One, the way Steve does it, which is he keeps track of it. And when he's done with it, he deallocates it, right? You do it by hand because you're in assembly language.
Yep.
There is garbage collection, which is an automated process and can be done well or poorly, that periodically on a timer goes through the system and says, are you using that? Do you need that? I'm like, okay, I'm going to let go. There's also what Rust does, which I think some people think is more effective, just another kind of garbage collection, which is counting by reference. So it just counts up how many times something uses it, counts down. When it's not being used, it releases it. All three have problems. There's no perfect way to do this because if you deallocate something and then use it, that's a use after free bug. So it's not unique to garbage collection. I think people would argue letting programmers do it is even worse.
So Yeah, in fact, yes. I mentioned in my notes, I said it could certainly be that in a non-automatic language like C, one thread or process manually frees some memory that another thread or process later attempts to use. In that case, the culprit is clearly a coding error. Either the memory should not have been freed when it was, or the coding or the code attempting to still refer to it later should have known not to attempt to do so. Or as in an instance we referred to recently, there was no actual error in the code at all, but there was a dangling pointer left around which pointed to some previously freed memory. The original code was not going to refer to that pointer, but a clever hacker figured out how to exploit it to their advantage.
So you could have written a perfect code.
Yes.
Release some memory, and then the bad guy modifies your code and attacks you. Oh, that's devious.
Yes. And so, you know, what we see is that the term use after free is a bit of a catch-all, you know, more than we'd like it to be. You know, it's a bit like when Microsoft describes a vulnerability by saying that it allowed a security restriction to be bypassed. Like, what?
Huh? Well, Yeah,
we're not really sure, but yeah, it seemed bad. So probably because it allowed a security restriction to be bypassed. But for what it's worth, this issue is a big deal. You know, it's been the sole topic of many computer science PhD dissertations. You know, there are people with, you know, doctor in their name because they wrote something, you know, they invented some new twist on garbage collection. In scrolling down through a lot of this stuff, Leo, you know, I saw simple examples, right, where many languages allow you to use a block structure where you'll open curly braces and do a bunch of stuff and then close curly braces. And the presumption is that that block is self-contained. So if inside those curly braces you were to just say, you know, A equals something or other, then the presumption is when you close the curly brace, because you implicitly declared and first used the variable A within the curly brace, that leaving the curly brace, that A is so-called, it's out of scope.
Scope.
As
scope
we say.
Variables. Almost all modern languages do that.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So, and again, super handy, super convenient, but you just need the language to know that, we're no longer responsible for talking about A. And if you do, it's the program.
It's an error. Well, and the compiler or the interpreter is going to go, hey, A is undefined. What are you doing?
Yeah, we don't know what that is now.
Yeah. The reason I'm defensive of GC is because every language I use has garbage collection. It's hard to find a language these days except for C and Rust and assembly.
I'm not sure where we are today, but there was a time when languages like the operation of a program would suddenly stall for no apparent reason. It's because the garbage collector had kicked in.
That's
was
a
like
problem.
Busy.
Yeah.
Yes.
You get these periodic pauses while it's going through the little robots going around looking. Got any garbage for me?
It's that guy with the little white mustache and
on a wheel. He's got
broom.
One wheel.
And he's got a little broom, and he's like, you know, sweeping along.
Yeah. I love this subject. Keep going. This is good stuff. This is also some ways the history of computing, really.
Yeah, and, you know, as our old-time listeners know, we had a lot of fun back in the early days of the podcast talking about how this all happened and the whole history of computing. So anyway, really all I want was that it is one of the reasons where that our listeners are sometimes confused is that use after free is not just one thing. It doesn't have one cause. It doesn't have one environment. You know, I've had people say, hey, you know, static languages don't have the problem. Yes, they do. Dynamic languages don't have the problem. Yes, they do. Again, it's like saying, oh, you know, this vulnerability is a security bypass. Okay. Well, and so use after free just sort of is more generic than we would like, but it serves as a catch-all for a large a large set of environments where a hacker was somehow able to reference memory in a way that wasn't intended. And so we just kind of call that use after free.
And don't. Is the second part.
And more specific details would be nice if we had them.
But, yeah. I never even thought about that. But of course, if a bad guy could write code that tried to access memory that had been deallocated, your code could be perfect. But the bad guy was able to modify that code. That's
yes.
Bad.
And what can happen is that if you've deallocated some code and then it's been reused, then the old pointer used to point to something in a different context.
Right.
Now it points to its new contents, which the attacker may have just managed to load.
Right.
So
I used to
software is hard.
I used to play with and love a language called Force.
Oh,
it was all in the stack.
The write-only language.
Yes.
you cannot read that language.
But you didn't really, I guess you could, as I remember, allocate memory. But the idea was it's a stack-based language. Everything's on the stack. But you could still overrun the stack. So even there.
Sure. And, you know, and for example, in C, local variables are on the stack.
Right.
Because our computer instructions provide a very nice stack pointer. Actually, it's a frame pointer reference,
right?
Because the stack might still be moving around.
Just this part of the stack
but
here. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when you exit from the routine, you so-called pop the stack, which just disposes of all of those temporary references. So
this stuff is fascinating. People who end up getting into programming often end up into writing their own interpreters, compilers, languages, because it is so interesting.
And we've also seen the phenomenon, if you give somebody an object oriented language, which inherently allows you to create meta language to describe the problem domain, you can end up spending all your time coming up with the coolest way to start getting ready to actually write some code.
That's kind of like Forth, too. That's why it's read only, because you write your own vocabulary. So you're writing in a language you understand, but nobody else does. And absolutely, that's the big thing of Lisp and in the schemes, the languages I love, is writing a domain-specific language. And you're right. You can spend your entire day doing that and not solving the problem.
Getting really ready to actually start.
I've
got this cool vocabulary.
Steve Gibson, so much fun. It's really great to have somebody who has roots in the past, understands the present, and can contextualize what's going on. That's what this guy does so well. Every Tuesday right here, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. If you want to watch it live, live.twit.tv. People who are watching live often head over to our IRC. Yes, we run an IRC server. Well, our community does at irc.twit.tv. You could chat live there. People who are members of Club Twit also have their own place to chat, our Club Twit Discord, which is a place going 24/7. In fact, we have a great coding section in there. We're talking about this kind of stuff all the time. If you are not a member of Club Twit, I want to invite you to join. It helps the network keep shows on that are maybe not necessarily self-supporting. As an example, that's where we do the Untitled Linux show. Dick DiBartolo's Giz Fizz is there. Stacey Higginbotham's Book Club. You also get ad-free versions of all the shows. So if you don't like ads, you don't want to be tracked, I completely understand. But that's how we subsidize ourselves. So you can do it for $7 a month. No more ads. That's all. Less than a couple of Starbucks coffees, unless you get one of those big Frappuccinos, and it's just one of them. $7 a month. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit for more information about Club Twit and all the benefits. Patrick Delahanty just did his fireside chat in the club. That's available online on the Twit Plus feed. We have Stacey's Book Club this week. Next week, Paul Thurrott is going to do a fireside chat. So, in fact, I really wanted to get you to do well, whatever you want, but you've already done one, but I think a vitamin D show for the club would be awesome. Twit.tv/clubtwit. If you want to get
copies of the show, there's two places you can go. Of course, our site, twit.tv/SN. Steve's got them, too. In fact, he has two unique formats. He's got the 64 kilobit audio, just like we do, but he also has a 16 kilobit version for people who just don't want a big file, for the bandwidth impaired. He also has transcripts written by the great Elaine Ferris. She writes it all down, so you can read along as you're listening, or even just read instead of listening, or, and the most useful thing, search the transcripts to find the part of the show that you're interested in. And that goes, do you have, you don't have transcripts for all the shows. You just have it for...
Yeah, we went back.
You went back?
And did it from day one.
Wow. Wow, that's really nice. Thank you. That's all at grc.com. While you're there, by the way, you might want to check out SpinRight. That's Steve's day job, his bread and butter. The world's best mass storage recovery and maintenance utility. You can pick up a copy of 6.0 right now. You'll get a free copy of 6.1 when it comes out if you buy today. You'll also get to participate in the development of 6.1. Steve's working very hard on that. It's imminent. GRC.com, plus lots of free stuff like Shields Up and so forth. And In Control, which I plugged on the radio show this weekend because somebody said, I never want to use Windows 11. I said, well, I've got a perfect program for you. Be in control. I guess that's all I need to say, except thank you again, Steve, for doing such a great job, and we'll see you next time on Security Now.
Always. Righto. We got one more episode this month because we got a normal size month, and we started at on the first of the month. So,
yeah,
on the 29th.
Spring is here. The spring edition.
Righto. Bye.
Hey, I'm Rod Pyle, editor of Ad Astra magazine, and each week I'm joined by Tarek Malik, the editor-in-chief over at space.com. In our new This Week in Space podcast, every Friday, Tarek and I take a deep dive into the stories that define the new space age. What's NASA up to? When will Americans once again set foot on the moon? And how about those samples from the Perseverance rover? When are those coming home? What the heck has Elon Musk done now? In addition to all the latest and greatest in space exploration, we'll take an occasional look at bits of spaceflight history that you probably never heard of, and all with an eye towards having a good time along the way. Check us out in your favorite podcatcher. Security Now.